It's the NPR News Update for Tuesday, May 5th. I'm Phil Picardi with the Minnesota News Podcast. Today, Minsure will be getting another new leader. One rural hospital is thriving. The governor and House Republicans inch closer together on taxes, keeping organic and conventional farmers from feuding. And what is the right to try? First, days before gunmen opened fire on an anti-Muslim cartoon drawing contest in Texas on Sunday, an Al-Shabaab militant from Minneapolis used Twitter to call for an attack. Laura Ewan reports.
Muhammad Abdullahi Hassan, who goes by the name Mujahid Miski, urged his followers to carry out an attack similar to those in France earlier this year. He tweeted, quote, "It's time for the brothers in the U.S. to do their part." He then provided details about the controversial contest soliciting cartoon portrayals of the Prophet Muhammad. Groups that monitor extremist online rhetoric say Hassan is one of the most influential recruiters out there. David Ibsen of the Counter-Extremism Project says Hassan uses technology to seek out those who might feel alienated in the U.S.
He knows how to, you know, kind of leverage that or manipulate those feelings for the purposes of the organization.
In 2008, Hassan left for Somalia to join the terror group Al-Shabaab when he was just 17. Laura Ewan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The University of Minnesota says it will release a report on more allegations of unethical research practices. Alex Friedrich has more.
The U has already received harsh criticism for its handling of a drug trial that ended in a patient's suicide in 2004. Some critics have been asking for an internal report on allegations of inappropriate recruitment of patients. Medical school dean Brooks Jackson says the U also wants to resolve complaints that some researchers are intimidating personnel who have pushed for more patient protections.
This is really a top priority to make sure that we have a culture that will be welcoming and inclusive.
Jackson says he hopes the U will release the document in about a week. Alex Friedrich, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Avian influenza has struck 8 more poultry farms in Minnesota, including a big chicken operation. Lorna Benson reports.
The layer hen farm in Nicollet County has more than 1.1 million chickens, the biggest single Minnesota flock lost to avian flu. The other 7 affected farms raise turkeys and are located in Renville, Kandi Ohi, Pipestone, and Swift counties. The lethal virus has now spread to a total of 80 Minnesota farms in 21 counties. More than 5.3 million birds in the state have been killed by the virus or euthanized to prevent its spread. Minnesota's first case of bird flu was confirmed 2 months ago on a Pope County turkey farm. So far, the reasons the disease continues to spread remain a mystery. 2,700 fecal samples taken from wild waterfowl have not produced a single finding of the virus in Minnesota. Lorna Benson, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Organic and conventional farmers sometimes struggle to coexist on the land. They often find themselves at odds over genetically modified crops or pesticide use. But on one Red River Valley farm, Dan Gunderson found that 2 generations with different approaches to farming can coexist.
Spring means nonstop activity at Cragness Farms, 20 minutes from Moorhead. David Cragness and his son Ben are putting corn seed in a planter in the farmyard. The Cragness family has farmed here since the end of the Civil War. Corn, soybeans, sugar beets, and wheat are traditional crops. David is 63. He planned on Ben, 29, taking over the farm someday.
I was even crazy enough to plot out in my head where he was going to do more and more and I was going to do less and less until he was doing all and I was doing nothing. And then he got the idea he wanted to raise a vegetable farm.
Cragness questioned his son's sanity.
I thought, that's too much work. You're crazy. But that's what he wants to do. He's not supposed to do what I want him to do. He's supposed to do what he wants to do.
6 years ago, Ben Cragness and his partner Tyne Stormo started growing vegetables on a few acres. 8 people signed up to buy the produce. He worked for his dad to pay the bills. This year, they hope the community-supported agriculture operation will have 225 members. The produce farm is now 13 acres, about 1% of the entire farmland. Ben says they use organic methods but are not a certified organic operation because he refuses to pay fees the federal government requires.
I got some broccolis planted last night. These look great.
Rows of tiny vegetables stretch across the field. 2 greenhouses are overflowing with plants ready to be put in the ground. Tyne Stormo says managing 80 varieties of plants is a delicate dance. Plant at the wrong time, and you'll be overwhelmed with the harvest.
When broccoli's ready, broccoli's ready. You get 3 days before it goes to flower, and so that's one of the challenges.
It's a lot of work. In fact, Ben and his dad agree it takes more work to grow 13 acres of vegetables than 1,300 acres of corn and soybeans. And despite his dad's misgivings about growing vegetables, Ben says he's become his biggest supporter.
When I have struggles, instead of criticizing them, he's always figured out ways to help me get around them.
Coexisting means making adjustments. David Cragness says they've established clear boundaries to protect the vegetable crops from pesticide drift.
When the wind is out of the north, there are certain places I spray around here, and when the wind is out of the south, I spray the other direction so that nothing goes on the organic stuff. So we have a separation. It seems to me that this can be maintained. We're certainly doing it on our farm. Is it convenient for both operators? No.
And neighbors have also taken pains to protect the vegetable operation, says Ben Cragness.
I've seen times where they've come back on a separate day to come spray part of their field, which is them going out of their way, having costs and time that they're doing just because they're really good neighbors.
Ben says sometimes during the summer, he arrives at the farm early in the morning to find his dad already hoeing weeds in the vegetable patch. Stormo says the CSA operation is now profitable.
You know, we work hard, and hourly wage, sometimes we probably don't make as much as we should, but it's passion, I guess. We're definitely not making millions, but we're successful. We're paying our bills. We have enough so that we can get a little bit more machinery each year.
In fact, because corn and soybean prices have crashed, David Cragness says he'll probably lose money on most of his crops this year, which makes his son's vegetable farm look like a smart choice.
This year, he's very likely to net more on his 13 acres than I am on the whole 1,350, that's for sure.
David Cragness has farmed his entire life, but watching his son's vegetable operation expand over the past 6 years has been an education.
They're growing stuff here. I did not know you could grow in Minnesota. I had no idea you could grow artichokes in this country, and I'm still not a Brussels sprout fan, so sorry. Some people are. That's the way the world works. Some people like Brussels sprouts. Some people grow corn and beans. So.
And on this farm, there's room for both. Dan Gunderson, Minnesota Public Radio News, Moorhead.
Minsure's chief executive is stepping down to take a new job. Scott Leitz is credited with bringing stability to the Minnesota Exchange after a disastrous first-year rollout. At a special board meeting yesterday, one of Leitz's lieutenants, Allison O'Toole, got the job of interim CEO. Mark Zedeklik reports.
Scott Leitz led a Minsure recovery that saw dramatic technical and customer service improvements. He came to Minsure the day its first leader resigned, under fire for taking a Caribbean vacation as Minnesota's exchange faced near collapse in its first weeks of operation. Light said working for Minsure was one of his most challenging and satisfying jobs.
Satisfying in the sense that I think the enormous amount of progress that we made over the course of the last 16 to 18 months to really get the system into good, stable working order, to get hundreds of thousands of people insured.
Lights is leaving for a position with a Washington, D.C.-based think tank called the Healthcare Cost Institute. He leaves at a time of considerable uncertainty about Minsure's future. There are calls at the legislature to dismantle Minsure in favor of sending Minnesotans to the federal exchange. There's also a move to abolish the Minsure Board of Directors and make the exchange a state agency with a governor-appointed, Senate-confirmed commissioner. But Leitz insists that uncertainty had nothing to do with his decision to move on from what has likely been one of the most challenging positions in state government of late. And he's not alone in leaving. Two board members whose terms are expiring this week are not seeking reappointment, including Chairman Brian Buettner, who says he's leaving to focus on his own business. Buettner downplayed the possibility that the exchange will face a leadership void. He credited Leitz with leading a Minsure turnaround and said it's natural to have leadership changes, especially early on in an organization's lifespan.
What I see here today is, quite frankly, a normal, healthy transition.
University of Minnesota political analyst Larry Jacobs agrees.
Scott Leitz's departure may initially seem like another sign of problems at Minsure, but actually I think it might be a sign of normalcy coming to Minsure. Scott Leitz came in and, by everybody's account, has done a superb job in bringing normalcy and calm and transparency.
MinSure's interim leader, Allison O'Toole, previously handled marketing and communications for the exchange. Outgoing board chairman Buettner says O'Toole's familiarity with the organization should help make for a smooth transition. Some Republicans were quick to cite Leitz's exit as the latest evidence that MinSure is a failure worthy of dismantling. Others take issue with the notion Leitz is leaving MinSure on stable ground. Alicia Riedel is the immediate past president of the Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters. She's highly complimentary of Leitz, but says MinSure still has major problems that need addressing.
They're in a critical time right now around how they prepare for open enrollment coming up. I think they're a critical time for doing some of the very, very basic but critical IT and technology fixes and build-outs that they have been promising for a couple of years and, you know, are still trying to, from what I understand, get them done for the next open enrollment.
Minutes after being named interim CEO, Allison O'Toole was already talking about year three of open enrollment this fall and building on improvements made from year one to year two.
That's where my main focus lies, because bottom line, the system needs to improve for the people it serves.
O'Toole formally takes over as interim CEO May 22nd. The MinSure board is expected to discuss the search for a permanent CEO at its monthly meeting in a week and a half.
Mark Zdechlik there. He reports on health finance issues, and last night he talked about rural hospitals on All Things Considered. They have struggled since the Great Depression, but on Minnesota's Iron Range, the city-owned hospital in Virginia has attracted millions of dollars in new investment. Only a few years ago, the Virginia Regional Medical Center was facing closure. The turnaround came from the city's controversial decision to get out of the hospital business and put Duluth-based Essentia Health in charge. Here's Mark to talk about it.
In the parking lot of Essentia Health Virginia, patient David Thomas Begich says he really likes the place.
It's a lot better than the old Virginia hospital, I think.
That kind of favorable review is far from what many Virginia residents were predicting as the city was negotiating an agreement to cede control of the hospital to executives 65 miles away in Duluth. Veteran emergency room nurse Joanne Miklovich was among the skeptics.
We did have concerns when Essentia did come in.
Miklovich and others worried jobs would disappear and that Virginia would become a bare-bones satellite operation that would mainly send patients to Essentia operations in Duluth. And history supplies plenty of reason for such concerns. University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill rural healthcare expert George Pink says a lot of rural hospitals have been consolidating with larger care organizations. He says often the smaller facilities see little new investment or growth.
A lot of the rural hospitals that are being acquired, they have expectations of capital being infused, of profitability turning around, and debt relief. And what we found was very little evidence that that is actually happening.
But there's plenty of evidence Essentia is investing in the Virginia hospital. There's a new million-dollar state-of-the-art lab where numerous tests are done in the same area. It replaced lab facilities spread out over several rooms. Another $1 million paid for an upgraded diagnostic imaging suite. Hospital Administrator Dan Milbridge says the new CT scanner is more efficient and safer than the old one.
This is much faster and delivers a lot lower dose of radiation to the patient.
Medical records are now available electronically, and an urgent care center is in the works.
We like to say we're making improvements all the time.
And there's growing agreement that ceding control of the facility from a city hospital board to Essentia Health was a good move.
It was a difficult decision to make, but it was necessary.
Virginia Mayor Larry Cuffey Jr. says the decision was also controversial.
The rub, I think, by some of the people in the community still is that we should have kept our own hospital, but it just wasn't financially feasible.
Cuffey says the city was out of options, that without the lease agreement with Essentia Health, the hospital would probably be closed by now.
The revenue that was generated from the city-owned hospital wasn't keeping up with the expenditures of the hospital.
Had the hospital closed, it would have cost the city upwards of 500 good jobs. Cuffey says that would have been comparable to a big mine shutting down.
It could have had an adverse effect and a domino effect on our economy. It is a major employer. It provides the opportunity for other people to come in. It also gives us a chance to fill our hotel and motels, our restaurants. It's just like the mining companies, for every mine worker, you know, there's probably 2.5 or 3 support staff jobs.
The city of Virginia still owns a hospital, but Essentia runs it now. Essentia says it's already spent $7 million upgrading the facility per the lease agreement. Essentia also has been paying down almost $6 million in hospital debt and can buy the hospital outright once the bonds are satisfied. Despite Essentia's infusions of capital, the hospital's workforce is slightly smaller than 2.5 years ago, but the annual payroll is up by more than $400,000 because the mix of jobs has changed to higher-skill, higher-pay positions. Hospital Administrator Dan Melbridge says Essentia's investments make sense from a business standpoint because the Virginia hospital will help the company manage its caseload system-wide.
Our intent is actually to beef up this hub so we can keep more patients from the northern region hospitalized here instead of sending them to Duluth. That also frees up tertiary beds down in Duluth for even the sicker patients. So in a way, we're unloading that burden from Duluth and kind of working as a system to provide as much local care as you can.
Milbridge says he thinks apprehension among staff members about Essentia's motives has eased as they've seen all the investments. But the union that represents a little more than 200 of its employees says relations with Essentia are not good. AFSCME Council 65 says the company is refusing to honor certain benefits in the contract the union negotiated last fall. The union has filed a complaint with the National Labor Relations Board as a result. Essentia declined to comment. Another union is pressing for changes as well. The Minnesota Nurses Association wants more nurses on staff. But that position predates Essentia taking control. An emergency room nurse, Joanne Miklovich, says Essentia has improved the hospital's operations.
They have the expertise to run a hospital versus what I saw in our city-owned management.
A former Virginia hospital board member agrees. Retired nurse Gail Baraboo now serves on a board advising Essentia. She says the people running the $1.8 billion hospital system are much better suited to run the hospital than the city was.
We were lay people. Some of us had some kind of medical background or knowledge base, but many of them on the board did not come from a medical background. There wasn't the expertise available to us that there is in a corporate situation.
ER nurse and Essentia skeptic Joanne Miklovich, 3 years later, says she's not complaining.
I'm not going to say there's anything bad about it.
Hospital consolidations can lead to higher costs for insurers. Catherine Hempstead of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation says there's evidence that prices tend to go up when hospitals merge. But she says that's not necessarily the case in smaller communities served by a single medical center.
In rural areas, providers sort of have a certain amount of market power to begin with because there's just not as much competition. So it's, everything is a little bit different in a rural context. And I think that, you know, you can imagine that there are opportunities for efficiency and improved quality when providers combine.
Essentia says it's made no changes to the charge structure at Virginia apart from inflation adjustments. Virginia City Council member Charles Baraboo says he hopes the partnership with Essentia will end up with the big company buying the hospital.
We do not want to go back into the hospital business. We want to stay out of it and eventually sell this facility to Essentia.
Should Essentia go the other route and leave Virginia, all of the upgrades will remain under the terms of the lease that some city officials say saved their hospital and hundreds of jobs. Mark Zadeklik, Minnesota Public Radio News, Virginia, Minnesota.
Governor Mark Dayton and House Republicans are still far apart on an overall budget deal, but they appear to be inching closer together when it comes to tax policy. Yesterday, Dayton said that he would be willing to consider lowering taxes on some Social Security income and giving Minnesotans a temporary income tax cut. Those are both key elements of the House tax plan. Tom Scheck has the report.
For the past month, Governor Dayton has criticized House Republicans for proposing $2 billion in tax cuts and spending little on education and other initiatives. He continued that criticism Monday.
They turn away from all those opportunities for tax giveaways, and especially when they're targeted toward the wealthier citizens of the state and the business community, is just unconscionable.
Dayton's ire focused mostly on phasing out a statewide business property tax and a repeal of the estate tax, two initiatives that he says will cause budget problems for the state in the future. But Dayton is signaling some areas where he could compromise with Republicans. One is the two-year income tax break in the GOP bill.
I probably shouldn't say this because this will ruin his chances, but it would be the individual tax relief, which is going to be directed toward all income brackets, but it's going to be directed certainly lower and middle income Minnesotans, and it's for 2 years.
Dayton said because the income tax break is temporary, it would be unlikely to cause future budget problems. The governor also said he'd be willing to lift a $25,000 ceiling on the amount of Social Security income that's exempt from Minnesota taxes. That would help some, but not all seniors who rely on Social Security. Republicans have proposed phasing out the entire tax on Social Security income. They also want to exempt retirement income for veterans.
I'm very, very happy that the governor is warming up to a few provisions.
Republican Greg Davids of Preston chairs the House Tax Committee. He said he's pleased Dayton appears to be open to some of his ideas. Davids, who has acknowledged his $2 billion tax cut plan isn't going to become law, said he crafted his tax bill to include Dayton's top tax measures, including an expansion of the state's child care tax credit.
I went through and picked out as many things out of the governor's bill as I could that made sense, and those are in the bill. I need to get a bill signed by the governor, and I didn't see where trying to repeal the fourth tier from 2 years ago or things like that that would antagonize, but I don't see how that moves the ball forward.
David said his top priorities heading into negotiations are to exempt Social Security income and provide tax relief to veterans. Senate Democrats also crafted a tax bill aimed at veterans, but instead of exempting retirement and pension income for veterans, the bill the Senate passed Monday provides a $2,500 tax break to businesses that hire veterans. DFL Senator Rod Scoy of Clearbrook is the author of the Senate bill.
Young men and women who served the country, did the hard work overseas, now they come home, having a hard time finding normalcy in their life. Nothing can help that like getting an opportunity to get up and go to work every morning and have an income.
The Senate passed the bill by a vote of 42 to 25. Three Republicans joined Democrats to support it. Scoy's bill also provides property tax relief and increases state aid to cities. Senate Republicans complained about the level of tax cuts in the bill. Republican Senator Julianne Ortman of Chanhassen said it should be more than a tenth of the budget surplus. And Ortman complained that Democrats have passed a gas tax hike and a metro-wide sales tax increase to pay for transportation projects in the transportation bill.
The question here is, where's the relief? Where are you going to offset the $2 billion in new taxes in the transportation committee, in the transportation bill? Where's the offset to the $2 billion in tax increases from 2 years ago that caused that surplus in the first place?
Negotiations over taxes and spending are expected to pick up this week. Dayton said he has separate meetings scheduled with Democrats and Republicans in the next few days. Tom Scheck, Minnesota Public Radio News at the Capitol.
Have you heard about the right to try? Kathy Werzer talked about it on Morning Edition this morning.
During our series, in which a Twin Cities man helped us understand what it was like to live with ALS, one of the experiences that Bruce Kramer shared was his participation in a clinical drug trial. Two, actually. Bruce Kramer talked about his frustration when one trial ended abruptly and his supply of the drug was cut off. He said concerns about long-term side effects shouldn't have applied in his case.
ALS is killing me, and I'm not going to be around for a long, 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 long time. So if that's the case, why not make the drug available?
And it appears that the Minnesota legislature shares that view. A right to try bill has both passed in the House and Senate and Governor Dayton has indicated that he will sign it. Under the legislation, terminally ill patients could use a drug, product, or device that has not been approved for general use by the FDA but is currently under investigation in a clinical trial. The bill's champion is Republican Representative Nick Zerwas. Zerwas credits an experimental procedure he had at the age of 15 with saving his life. He was born with a three-chambered heart and from a young age endured many medical procedures, including one that damaged his vocal cords. Representative Zerwas joins me this morning on the phone. Good morning, Representative.
Well, good morning, Jesse. Thank you for having me on.
Tell me a little bit about the procedure that saved your life.
There was a procedure, a heart reduction procedure that showed success. It had been done several times in South America. And they said, you know what, we want to try this. We think it's the only thing we can do. It probably won't be successful for you, but we think if we try this, we're going to learn so much that it might work for the next 15-year-old boy. And really through the miracle of life, woke up after that, was out of the hospital in 7 days, and started high school, I think, about 6 weeks later.
Wow.
And so that was really the impetus for me to wholeheartedly sign up to support legislation like Right to Try. My family and I, we were blessed with the opportunity to try.
You know,
not have to give up.
And so let me ask you about the bill then. Why do you think it's important?
Well, I think philosophically and just kind of big picture-wise, I don't think the federal government should have a role in telling a patient facing a terminal disease, you can't do anything else to try to save your life. You can't try this. You need to just wait to die. And so by removing that obstacle and that barrier of government from someone's decision between them and their doctor and their family to try to extend their life, I don't think the federal government plays a role in that. And in being in that position, you know, many years ago myself, it really struck a chord with me.
As you know, Representative, FDA regulations allow access to investigational drugs for treatment purposes on a case-by-case basis for patient compassionate use. But the drug company has to agree, and the FDA can't compel the company to do so. In the case of Bruce Kramer, the gentleman that you heard, the drug company refused. So the question, I guess, is what then is the point of a law such as this if the drug company isn't forced to comply?
Yep, and there's nobody in this arrangement is forced to comply. The difficulty with compassionate use is the amount of red tape and regulation. Sometimes the process, the approval process, can take in excess of 6 months. It's hundreds of pages of documentation and regulation. And this is an attempt to streamline that and really to allow people just greater access.
Are you concerned at all that this could disrupt the clinical trial process?
You know, that concern has not been shown in the states that have already implemented this. This type of legislation was passed in Arizona by a huge margin with a voter referendum. It has been enacted in multiple states across the country, and we just haven't heard that type of concern.
All right. Representative Zerwas, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for having me. Have a great morning.
Kathy Werzer on Morning Edition. I'm Phil Picardi with the NPR News Update. Thanks for coming along. Wednesday News right here tomorrow.